Hello, welcome to the radio.
Have you guys seen that thing where it like plays welcome to the radio?
That's what they say on the radio, right?
Welcome to the movies.
Welcome to another episode of television. Welcome to Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn about anything and everything that we find interesting and cool and science-y.
Mm-hmm. Science!
Cool is new. We have to be cool now.
Today we are going to go real deep into a big science topic. We are going to answer a science question. And we're just going to take a little tiny walk around a miscellaneous topic. Little tiny baby walk. My name is Ella. I'm covering today's main science topic, which is the maths of conspiracy theories.
Oh! I'm so excited. I love me a good conspiracy theory. Oh my god.
I was going to say, we've covered one or two conspiracy theories in a miscellaneous topic, and I feel like all of our science brains something's here, and mm-hmm. So this is great. I'm so excited.
My name's Caroline, and this episode's question is gonna be, why isn't Pluto a planet?
I actually don't know the answer.
Like everybody has an answer in their head. But is that the actual answer? We'll find out today.
I don't know the final verdict.
Yeah.
I'm so excited.
I also feel like this one gets people really riled up. So.
Yeah, people are real mad about Pluto.
Yeah.
My name's Tom, and today's miscellaneous topic is animal art. And it actually comes with a miscellaneous question, which is, can animals make art?
So this is like elephants who do paintings and things?
Yeah, that's what they're saying. And is the elephant left or right handed doing the painting? Throwback.
Now, have you guys noticed a pattern with Ella's topics so far? If you take the first word of each topic and you combine them together, you get conspiracy theory?
It spells out, I have a PhD, bitch.
Coincidence?
I've been playing the long game. This is the last one. Okay, so today's main topic is the maths of conspiracy theories. I'm going to do a deep dive into one specific paper, which is a paper called On the Viability of Conspiratorial Beliefs by Robert David Grimes from the University of Oxford.
Ooh.
And this
great title
paper basically establishes a simple mathematical model for conspiracies involving multiple actors over time, which outputs the probability of failure for any given conspiracy. And we're going to really get into how it worked.
Interesting.
And at the same time, look at both real and unproven conspiracies.
Fake conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Oh, I've got a really loud plane going by. Hold on. Like insanely loud.
I heard it for a second. Cool. Now, is that the US government flying over Ella's house?
I like how you immediately go to US government rather than our own government for this sort of stuff.
They're both guilty of a lot of things. I was going to say, to your point, it is interesting that that even the phrase conspiracy has sort of like lost its meaning of like a group of people conspiring to feel more like a group of people thinking that a thing is happening.
Exactly. A conspiracy is unreal. Each of us believes in conspiracy theories. Like there are conspiracies that we also believe. We just think they're more legitimate, right? So Grimes' paper does have a working definition of a conspiracy theory.
Oh, great. Oh, we love a working definition.
Oh, yeah.
So this is from Sunstein et al.'s paper, Conspiracy Theories, Causes and Cures.
Ooh.
And the definition is an effort to explain some event or practice by reference to the machinations of powerful people who attempt to conceal their role at least until their aims are accomplished. So the parameters of this model are estimated from examples of known scandals, and the factors influencing conspiracy success and failures are explored within it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to look at both of these things in more detail.
Oh, amazing.
He then goes on to use the model to estimate the likelihood that claims from some commonly held science conspiracy theories would be revealed.
Oh. I was going to ask if this isn't a question you were going to ask, Ella, because I know, Caroline, you are very big into conspiracy theories. Is that right?
Here's the thing with me. I love reading about conspiracy theories, but I don't really put much weight onto, like, I don't really believe any of them. I just enjoy seeing how other people's brains work. I enjoy, like, taking those things in and being like, oh, maybe that is real, and then rationalizing it and being like, no, that's stupid. But I just enjoy, like, reading.
Interesting.
I get that. Yeah, I like learning about conspiracy theories, but then sometimes you get a bit freaked out. Not by the fact that I think the conspiracy theory will be real, but there are people out there that believe it, you know?
Who believe these things,
Oh, what are your thoughts on conspiracy theories, Tom?
I feel pretty much, I'm more on the frightened by them sometimes. But at the same time, you know, there are, I am also, I mean, there are legitimate conspiracies like the Iran-Contra affair in the United States. There's been a lot of stuff that has been bad in the United States, but yeah, I think I lean more towards feeling uneasy by some of them.
Yeah.
Yes. So in the first part of this paper, Grimes makes a model which is very it's a very complicated looking equation, and I'm not going to try and explain it. It's in its entirety. If you are interested, the paper is in the show notes. But some things the model considers are the number of conspirators, the time the conspiracy is kept a secret, death of conspirators over time.
Whoa. Now I want to see that model, because I want to see, like, X equals death of conspirators over time in the equation.
I mean, it's the idea is that the model will output, when you put in known conspiracies that have been revealed, the probability of an intrinsic leak or failure per conspirator over time.
Oh.
The model also makes some assumptions, like that the conspirators involved are very actually dedicated to concealing their activity, that a leak from any one of them is enough to expose the conspiracy, which is probably a slight overestimation. It also does not consider the possibility that external agents could reveal the operation. It's all internal leaking.
So this is like a conservative lower bound then, right?
Yes, exactly. And we'll cover that a little bit as well, how it tries to go for the lower bounds. I'll also point out here that Grimes makes estimations about how the likelihood of the conspiracy being revealed decreases as conspirators die, but there's a mistake in an early equation, meaning that this part of his model isn't accurate. He did publish corrections for this.
Oh.
And the scandals he inputs and the scandals that we are looking at are all, like, relatively short-lived, where no or few conspirators would have died before it was revealed. So it doesn't actually affect the outcomes of the paper or the conclusions he draws, but it's just something to consider if you wanted to go and take this model to look at a conspiracy which has taken place over a much longer period of time.
That's wild. I love this idea that you can take what feels like such a complex human thing and then be like, let's crunch the numbers on this.
Yeah. Yeah. All of this has left his building of the model in the first part of the paper leaves us with a very complicated looking equation, which in theory you can use to tell the probability, as I said, of a conspiracy failing over time per conspirator, and depending if the number of conspirators are constant or not. But to get actual estimates from this equation, Grimes has to input actual data from known historical scandals.
Amazing. Which, what a data set.
Yeah,
I'm
right?
So excited.
It must be so much fun.
So for this, he uses three examples.
The lizard overturning of the US government in 1994,
of course.
The queen's a lizard, yeah, duh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, the queen's a hemophiliac, and that actually means she's a werewolf.
The hidden third moon behind the second moon.
The moon actually being hollow. Or there being a dragon on the moon. That's one of my favorites.
I've never heard hollow moon theory before.
Apparently, if you throw a stone on the moon, whilst you're on the moon, it sounds hollow. It's completely made up, but...
See, and that's, I gotta say, that's one of the things about these conspiracy theories is if, and it, I think that it's called like the Gish Gallop, where it's just like, if you say so many wrong things at the same time, you can't, it's hard to find the one in that sentence to point out. Cause I'm just like, how do you get on the who tested who's with what? When? What? How would you know?
So, our three historical scandals. I'll walk you through them very briefly.
Oh, I'm excited.
There's the Prism affair. Do either of you know what that is?
No.
No.
It's the NSA, the National Security Agent, and allies were collecting civilians' private internet data from around 2006, and it was exposed by intelligence contractor Edward Snowden in 2013.
Right.
The next one is the Tuskegee syphilis study.
Yeah, I have heard about this. There's also, if anyone's curious, there's a great episode of the podcast You're Wrong About that talks about this.
Yes, I definitely recommend looking into this more because it's a very classic case of like historical racism in like the medical community in the US. So this is a study of 600 black men, 399 of which had syphilis, by the US Public Health Service starting in 1932. So researchers told these men they were being treated for bad blood, which is a local term used to describe several ailments, including syphilis, anemia, and fatigue. By 1943, penicillin was the choice treatment for syphilis and was widely available and cheaply available. But the men in the study were not offered the treatment with the intention of observing the effects of the disease when it went untreated.
Oh.
Which is
fucked up. So as a result, more than 100 of those men died.
Oh my God.
And this wasn't exposed until 1972 by Associated Press reporter Gene Hurley. And the last one, which is the only one of these I hadn't heard of, is the FBI crime lab scandal.
I mean, again, not surprised it's the FBI, but yeah. No, I haven't heard about this.
So this is a quote from a 2015 Washington Post article, which is something else. Okay.
Oh boy.
The Justice Department and FBI have formally acknowledged that nearly every examiner in an elite FBI forensic unit gave flawed testimony in almost all trials in which they offered evidence against criminal defendants over more than a two-decade period before 2000.
Oh my God!
Two decades are big numbers.
The cases included those of 32 defendants sentenced to death. Of those, 14 have been executed or died in prison. Yeah.
How? I feel like we should all know about that one.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, well, so they didn't formally acknowledge it until 2015, although they overhauled the system a lot earlier than that. So it was Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, who was a chemist in the FBI crime lab, who initially investigated and exposed the scientific misconduct in 1996. And he basically exposed the revelation that pattern-based forensic techniques like hair and bite mark comparisons were incredibly biased towards the prosecution and were ultimately led to many wrongful convictions because they were incorrect in dozens and dozens of cases.
Wow.
So
not quite the same fun as like lizard people, definitely the same severity as lizard people. I would say
yes. One of the things I find really interesting about all of these scandals is that they're all government bodies. So now we have the data to put into our equation, which should give us our value for P, so the probability of a leak or failure.
Cool.
Because all of these have a relatively short time frame, the number of conspirators is assumed to be constant over time. And the number of conspirators is assumed to be around the number of staff in the institution the scandal came from. Okay. So 30,000 at the time for the NSA, 6,700 for officers in the United States Public Health Service, and 28 agents in the FBI crime lab. Grimes acknowledges that in the NSA and Public Health Service cases, that those are high estimates.
Yeah.
But he says that taking a larger value for these tends to overestimate the ability of a mass of conspirators to retain a secret, yet it allows us to set an extreme lower bound for P, the failure of odds per unit time per conspirator. This essentially yields a best case scenario.
Yeah.
Okay.
We also have to consider how long the scandal was kept a secret. Mm-hmm. So for each of these three scandals, the longest realistic time was inputted, again, to give the best case scenario. So with the, for example, the Tuskegee syphilis study, although that started in the 30s, it wasn't until 1942 that the treatment became available. So they did from that point, 1942, the very earliest it became available to the point it was leaked by the Associated Press in the 70s, so about a 30-year time frame. So now they've applied these numbers to the actual model, and they've taken the lowest probability of failure per conspirator over time, which comes out as a very generous 4 times 10 to the minus 6, which is like 0.00005.
And so that's the probability that it would have been kept a secret.
No, that it would be leaked by a single person.
Oh, okay.
Oh, So I'm sorry. So the calculations are saying that it is very unlikely that these would have been leaked by a person internally.
Yes, correct? Basically, but they were leaked is the point.
Yeah.
He's making it extremely conservative.
Yes, it's a very conservative estimate, so that when you put in these current conspiracy theories, the number that is output is more realistic to people who might not believe in this study.
Okay.
Got it.
Yeah.
So he's doing these numbers with like one hand behind his back to prove that these fake conspiracies are very unlikely.
Yes, exactly. They would have been revealed if this number of people were involved.
So interesting.
If I'm following where this thread is going to go, basically that like, the chance for these real conspiracies to have been leaked is extremely low. And using that same model where these are extremely low probabilities, we're going to see what happens with fake conspiracies.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. I'm excited. I'm sorry. Wait. Does he list fake conspiracies?
Yes.
Oh, I'm so excited. Again, what an amazing data set. I'm very excited to look at this paper after this.
First of all, so there are 4 fake conspiracies that he inputs into the model. Can you guess what they are? They're very popular ones.
Gotta say moon landing, baby.
Yeah, it's gotta be moon landing, right? Yeah.
Let's see moon landing! That's my favorite episode of Family Feud was the conspiracy one.
What year was this paper published?
Great question.
Oh, 2016?
Okay.
The conspiracy that there's a secret podcast that only Caroline and Tom does. It's released on the other Thursdays that this episode is. Sorry, continue.
It's not something JFK related.
No,
it?
These are all science conspiracies.
Oh.
Gosh. Oh, are they going to make me sad?
How disappointed are we going to be?
Some of them are going to make you sad. We'll go through them now. I'm going to get a little bit into each of these. Not too deep, because they could each like be their own topic. But I do think it is my moral and civic duty to say how these have been debunked.
Great.
So the first one is, the NASA moon landing was faked. So in 1969, the Apollo 11 mission put the first man on the moon.
Woo!
In 2013... This is so bad, guys. It was estimated that 7% of Americans, which is 22 million people, subscribed to the view that the moon landings were faked.
No.
Wow.
That's ridiculous.
And the US did it too, is the
word. Yeah.
Like it's the same country that did it.
It's a big old race that happened, and instead of backing yourselves.
It is an interesting one, because a lot of people who subscribe to conspiracy theories are often like very patriotic in nature.
Yeah.
And so that this is like something that they don't believe, I think is almost detracting from their own like sense
of self.
It's
really interesting. Yeah. It's just too good of a conspiracy.
Mm-hmm. I think that obviously one of the reasons this arose is because it happened during the Vietnam War. And a lot of the beliefs were about that it was a propaganda kind of move to distract from that.
Yeah.
It is more of a dying conspiracy for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And NASA has put out incredibly detailed and well-documented evidence of the moon landing. You can look at every single... Because it, by law, NASA has to reveal all of their like images and their maths and their research, it's all out there very clearly. But in particular, people often point to the images taken on the moon as being the faked thing.
Yeah.
Which they're very unreal images because they're on the moon.
They look insane. I was looking through them before when I was writing this, and I think they're so beautiful. I'm going to get a poster of one. But there's a paper linked in the show notes called Invisible Evidence: Pictorial Enhanced Disbelief in the Apollo Moon Landings. And that goes through each point of how people think the images might be faked and gives a scientific reason why the scientists don't think that's the case. So I'd look at that if you want to like be someone who can debunk this stuff off the cuff.
It's also really, I will say, the only benefit to this conspiracy is there's been a lot of great explainers that have come out of this to explain this. I love a side interest of mine is like visual effects stuff. And I know there's a ton of visual effects videos breaking down like why these images look strange, like because of the fact that there's like weird lighting, because it's like a uniform lighting from the sun. There's one really cool one that NVIDIA did where they rendered this image of a photograph that was taken on the moon, and the lighting was weird, and so they were like, oh my gosh, is this gonna like, did we accidentally support the conspiracy? And then they realized they forgot to put the astronaut who is taking the picture in the scene, who has like a white space suit that was super reflective, and then once they added that in, it like, it looked exactly like the picture. So it's all,
there's a bunch of like small things like that. Like, why are there no, people often say like, why are there no stars in this image? And it's like, because it's actually so daytime on the moon.
Exactly.
And if you took a picture of, even if you took a picture of stars at night with the cameras they had at the time on Earth, you wouldn't see them in the image. So it's kind of like, there's like very simple explanations, but you need to be willing to like be the person who's gotten all the evidence together and remembered it, which is, you know, difficult.
That's a task in its own right, isn't it?
Totally.
I will say this paper that I'm talking about isn't actually about debunking this hoax. It's looking at the origins of it, trying to understand why people believe it, and how the images are used as part of like culture and conspiracy. It's a really interesting paper.
Oh, interesting.
But that's the first fake conspiracy looked at. The next is climate change isn't real.
Oh, that's such an obvious one. I'm already annoyed.
Temperature data shows us that global temperatures have risen rapidly over the past few decades, the last 8 years being the hottest in recorded history. The number commonly quoted is that 90% of published climate scientists agree that climate change trends are extremely likely to be due to human activity. The 97% figure is a bit wishy-washy, actually, but we don't, like, people seem to quote that but don't have any like source for it.
But if you
look at reviews of the wider literature, there is always an overwhelming consensus among scientists that climate change is real and man-made. Sometimes it's as high as like 99%,
which is higher than even like other things in science that we firmly believe. Like,
yeah, it's insane. Like, this is like a consensus like no other. And papers that disagree with it often can't be replicated or contain very obvious errors. And yet many still believe climate change isn't real. And it's, you know, it's because it's a very deeply political issue that's used as like a chess piece. And I understand how you could come to believe it was a conspiracy when you have people that govern you straight up telling you it isn't real.
That's a great point.
One of the things I find really interesting about this conspiracy theory is that conspiracies usually have underlying benefits for the people who've created the conspiracy, but this is like one that just doesn't have a benefit for the science, because it's all like academic research scientists that are saying this, who are paid terribly, by the way.
Can I say that? That always is the moment in the conspiracy where I'm like, okay, but y'all, they're not like swimming around in Ferraris. These are scientists.
Exactly, yeah. Where do you think, what are they benefiting from here?
Yeah.
But if you guys want a real fucking conspiracy that was uncovered, let me read from a 2018 Guardian article, okay? In 1982, oil company Exxon predicted that by about 2060, CO2 levels would reach around 56 parts per million, double the pre-industrial level, and that this would push the planet's average temperatures up by about 2 degrees Celsius over then-current levels. Exxon scientists predicted devastating sea level rise and warned the American Midwest and other parts of the world would become completely desert-like. In 1988, an internal report by Shell, another oil company, projected similar effects, but also found that CO2 could double even earlier by 2030. Shell's assessment foresaw a 1 meter sea level rise and noticed that warming could also fuel disintegration of West Antarctic ice sheet, resulting in a worldwide rise in sea level of 6 to 5 meters. That would be enough to inundate entire low-lying countries. Exxon and Shell did not publish these reports to the public. In fact, they actively suppressed them. They lied about climate change and prevented governments from enacting clean energy policies because it would have affected their bottom line. That is a conspiracy.
That's a conspiracy that literally did happen. Yeah.
And again, to your point, has a material benefit to the people lying or conspiring.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So, fuck anyone who believes that conspiracy, to be honest, because there are actual people who are benefiting from the other way around.
Yeah, if you want to take your conspiracy muscles and, like, work them out, there is a place for
that. There's a really good one where you can be really angry at people in a position of power. Like, you don't have to be angry at scientists.
I just find it amazing that Exxon and Shell had these reports that said, yeah, in about 30 to 60 years, there will be entire countries underwater.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Whoopsies. Oh, well. Okay. Oh, well.
Money, money, money.
The third real fake conspiracy theory is a classic, a real classic, that the cure for cancer is being withheld by pharmaceutical companies.
God. What?
Yeah, this is a good one.
Have you never heard this one, Tom?
I mean, I guess I can understand it. I don't know if I've specifically run into this one.
Yeah, I know this. I've heard this a bit.
I assume you would run into this significantly more.
Yeah, I posted a TikTok asking people what their, like, what their families conspiracy theories were, and this one came up quite a lot. I actually I don't believe it, but I get where it comes from.
Yeah,
sure,
because like what we were saying with the last one, there is at least, like, it's the idea that it's lucrative to treat cancer,
right,
with expensive but not always effective treatments, and then rather than sell the secret cure, it's wrong. But I get where people's kind of conspiracy brains have come in here.
The point that I can understand, especially with cancer, is that I think people say cancer and you think of one thing, when actually, like...
That's also
this is exactly
point.
What
yeah.
I was going to say.
Like, a general misunderstanding of how cancer works, which, as somebody who has a degree in biology, I don't fully understand how cancer works. You know, like...
Great point.
So this conspiracy just ignores the fact that cancer is not a single disease. It's a very large group of diseases with different causes. And in order to cure it very effectively, it has to be treated in different ways. So right now, chemotherapy is, like, very widely used on most cancers, but it's like killing a fly with a flamethrower, you know? It'll get the job done, but you're going to burn everything else in the process. So the idea that there's, like, a secret cure all for cancer is an honestly insane notion. And it also ignores the fact that most of this research, it doesn't come out of pharmaceutical companies. It starts at a much like an academic level.
Yeah.
Great point.
The final conspiracy looked at is a very popular one right now. Getting more and more popular by the day. Can you have a guess?
Oh boy. It's not flat earth, is it?
No, he didn't look at
that
one.
It's not to do with vaccines, is it?
Yes.
So
in the paper, it's specifically referring to the conspiracy that the MMR vaccine causes autism, which is peddled by the infamous ex-Dr. Andrew Wakefield.
Yeah.
Everybody should know by now that that paper was shunned by the entire scientific community, and he retracted it himself. Like,
it took The Lancet 12 years to retract that paper, which is shocking.
Far too long.
But it has been retracted, and it has been thoroughly debunked. It was shown, it was proven he falsified data.
Mm-hmm.
It was shown that he stood to financially gain from the claim he was trying to make, because he was secretly trying to patent single shots for measles, mumps and rubella. And there have been many follow-up studies shown that vaccines and autism are not linked.
And again, that's the conspiracy, is that he made this bunk paper.
Yeah, and the papers not showing this are, like, very bittersweet to me. I understand that they're necessary, and I commend the scientists who carried out that research. But I'm so frustrated that good scientists and, like, doctors who could have been doing other things have had to spend their life debunking their lives.
It's just such a waste of time. Yeah. Still having to this day, when you could be doing literally anything else with the time and the money.
Yeah.
It could go to such better things.
It takes so much more work to correct the truth than it does to tell a lie.
Uh-huh.
There's also a great H Bomber Guy video debunking this.
Oh yeah, it's so good.
He also has as much rage as we do, which is great.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's very, very long. So if you love bread tube, then
but hey, if you like this podcast, maybe you're, like, okay with that.
I think the thing about this conspiracy is, and the Kant's one as well, is that unlike the moon landing conspiracy, it has like devastating consequences.
Right.
Yeah.
So with this one, it's estimated that as many as 20% of Americans believe this.
Wow.
Which is insane. And it's led to a hugely reduced uptake in the MMR vaccine and other vaccinations.
Which is the measles, mumps, and rubella,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And it means that there's a huge resurgence yeah. of measles, which had effectively been eradicated before this, which is devastating.
People don't realize how awful having measles is. It can change your entire life, and it could be solved with one vaccine that covers you for so many different things. And it frustrates me so goddamn much.
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go. I feel like that noise like really sums up how we feel about it. Just okay.
But moving back to the model, we have our conspiracies.
Yeah. Now let's crunch the numbers.
Now let's crunch some numbers.
Oh yeah.
I'm just going to tell you what when these were put into the model, what the failure time was predicted for them. So
interesting.
The moon landing hoax failure of this conspiracy would have been 3.68 years.
Oh, wow.
Not very long.
Yeah, climate change fraud, if only scientists were involved, is 26.77 years. Climate change fraud, okay. if scientific bodies were also included, which they would have to be realistically,
I was going to say,
is
yeah.
3.7 years.
And again, this is keeping in mind that this same model on real conspiracies was extremely
yeah, exactly.
conservative. And so
extremely conservative, yeah.
A vaccination conspiracy, if only the CDC and the WHO are involved, that's 34.78 mm-hmm. years. Vaccination conspiracy, if mm-hmm. also the drug companies are involved, is 3.15 years.
So either way, we'd already know about
yes,
it.
Yes, absolutely yeah. would. And then the yeah. suppressed cancer cure is 3.17 years. I think some of these numbers are probably a little bit low because the amount of conspirators that were put into the model. Mm-hmm, so, for example, mm-hmm. for the moon landing hoax, Grimes put the numbers of conspirators at 410,000, which is the number of NASA employees in 1965. But it's not like every person in NASA, including the cleaners and lunch ladies, would know about the hoax.
Sure,
so
sure.
So 3.68 years is probably a low estimate of failure time. But even conspiracies with a low number of conspirators, like the vaccine conspiracy, which has about 22,000, which is a very low estimate for actually how many people would have to know about this, that would still yeah. be revealed
right, right.
in decades. Mm-hmm. Also, Grimes, obviously, he did use these early parameters that are very favorable for conspirators. There's this very low estimate of probability that a single conspirator would
yeah.
reveal it.
Right, right.
And it also doesn't take into account, like I already said, outside actors revealing the conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what this entire paper boils down to is going to seem incredibly obvious. The more conspirators that are involved, the faster the conspiracy would be revealed. But more importantly, it would be revealed.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, on the one hand you are right that it feels like a clear thing that you could say with one sentence, but I will say this analysis with real examples does make it feel a lot more real.
Yes.
Right? Like
yeah,
you can
definitely.
Just say that, but then you when you get the number of years and then these like real things and then fake things from history, you're like, "Oh, okay. Yeah, that's tremendously unlikely."
Yeah. Grimes kind of comments that although conspiracies undoubtedly do happen in the real world, their continued yeah. secrecy is probably due to the number of agents being very, very low. So you have a like mm-hmm. less of a probability of leaking. And we see that, you know, we see that they're in, maybe not in non-scientific conspiracies, like things like that we all kind of agree as a society happened, but we don't have definitive proof because a lot of the people would have died or there would have been few people involved, like the US government peddling drugs to black communities in the US, for example.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
On the kind of importance of this research, Grimes writes, "One of the major motivations of this work is to help counteract anti-science beliefs from gaining a foothold by quantifying how extraordinarily unlikely it is that a cohesive scientific fraud could take place on such massive scales. This applies not only to stances examined here, but also to the wild array of popular anti-science beliefs. A sizable contingent still hold conspiratorial conviction about a range of topics, including genetically modified organisms, water fluoridation, and AIDS denialism, to name a few prominent examples. It is important to challenge such narratives, as not only are they detrimental to our health and well-being, current researchers suggest that exposure to conspiratorial beliefs can affect our perception of events to a greater degree than we are aware."
Mm, mm.
So I thought that was pretty important.
Yeah, definitely.
The paper ends on, like, I think a very important point, that this model is very unlikely to convince someone who is very invested in conspiracy theory already. Mm-hmm. But
yeah,
for less invested and into this kind of intervention, like showing them this kind of data might be quite useful.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
If someone in your family, your friends, is like slipping into this area, but they're not completely gone, then this would be a good thing to show them.
That's really cool that that paper acknowledges that aspect of it, because it feels like such a complex topic, and the fact that they are willing to both like crunch the numbers, do the analysis, and then also take into consideration ways to mitigate it all. It's really cool.
Yeah. That's me. Sorry to bum you out.
Every now and then, we need to have those serious conversations. And I feel like this paper and then this section feels like a very, very good way to handle these sorts of things, you know?
Yeah.
What's the name of the paper and the author of
the
paper?
It's On the Viability of Conspiratorial Beliefs by Robert David Grimes.
So, this episode's question is, why is Pluto not a planet? I picked this because I remember when I was younger and this whole thing happening, basically, and Pluto being demoted from a planet to
Pluto fiasco.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people have really strong feelings about it, and I want to eke that out of both of you as well, if you have any strong opinions. Let's dive into it. First off, I'm going to straight up ask you if you two know why Pluto was demoted.
Too small.
That's my... is it also having to do with its orbit being wonky?
So, you're both, like, kind of there, but we're going to smoosh your ideas together, basically.
Did it not join the Paris Accords in the appropriate amount of time, and so it had to leave the Union? Can I also, I'm trying to think, like, what makes a planet?
Yeah, this is going to be a question, is what is the definition of a planet? So hold on to those thoughts for a second, and we'll process through it together.
Okay. Ella, how do you feel about the planethood of Pluto?
I don't care.
I knew Ella wasn't gonna care.
I don't care. They could be like, all of them, none of them planets anymore.
None of
them would just be like,
anymore.
Yeah.
All right,
fair enough.
I mean,
it's still there. It's not like it's gone anywhere.
Exactly. On the one hand, I can understand this as like a fun thing to be defensive about. Because,
to have a little debate about, yeah.
Yeah, and because I had this realization that me and some of my friends are all have the same kind of broken brain where we over sympathize with inanimate objects.
Yeah.
We were driving in the car and we were at a red light and this garbage truck drove past and there was a tiny garbage bag that was like trailing along in the afterdraft, and my friend was like, oh, he's trying to get back on the track. I was like, it's literally a garbage bag.
This is what Toy Story has done to our generation.
I mean, yeah,
literally.
So I can totally understand wanting the fun of being like, I want to stick up for this little guy.
We're sticking up for the underdog that is Pluto.
On the other hand, I feel like people have some resentment for this because of a feeling of like, you told me one thing and now you're telling me another thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And from my perspective, I mean, you know, I can understand that, but from my perspective, it's a good thing that we are learning more about these planets, and if we change the definition, it's probably because we have more information about it.
And typically, that's how science works, that we learn something new and we change how we view it. And that's typically a very good thing. And if we are angry at that, then we have a problem, you know? It's like, that's just how science works. That's how every single aspect of science works, including space. Yeah. So changing what is and isn't a planet isn't necessarily a bad thing. Even though I feel like we all have a lot of nostalgia for Pluto as well. And a lot of like those like,
no.
Oh yeah, nine planet. No, Ella's just like, nah, fuck
yeah,
this.
My very educated mother just served us nine pizza pot. Pizzas. Is it pizzas?
My very easy method, just so I know Pluto. Just so you know Pluto. you.
You with you. Caroline, I was going to say, because something you said made me think something. Did the qualifications of what a planet is change, or did we learn more about Pluto
and
it changed, went out of the definition?
The definition was established.
As in, wait, what do you mean?
There wasn't a set definition of a planet before we demoted Pluto.
Oh. Okay, so in fact, it was never a planet.
Well, so, kind of, yeah.
None of them were.
None of them were planets, and then we made them.
Definitely the more interesting answer.
So good, isn't it? So we'll talk about this idea of Pluto being too small first. Because I think that's what everybody thinks of when we say, why was Pluto demoted?
Right.
Because it's teeny tiny.
To get to the other side. Sorry.
And is it because it's made of ice?
No, it's not. But that's composition. A really good... Ella, you were about to say something else. Finish that sentence.
No. Yeah. Oh, no, I feel pressured to get it right. I retract everything I've said.
All right. Let's talk about the size thing first, because it is linked to the definition, but it's not just because of how small Pluto is, and size actually isn't included in the definition of a planet whatsoever.
Surprised.
Yeah, interesting, right? So Pluto is teeny fucking tiny. We all know this. It's about half the width.
That's a scientific term.
Yeah, it'd be a small boy. It's about its width is half the width of the US.
Oh, fuck. Wow. It's actually very...
It's
very
about two-thirds the size of the moon. Like, it's so, so small. Pluto itself has five moons. The largest one, which is called Charon or Charon. It's spelled C-H-A-R-O-N. Mm-hmm. It's about half the size of Pluto. So it's relatively fucking humongous compared to Pluto. But because Pluto is so small, that moon causes Pluto
like
to have, like,
sized.
A wobble. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so see, that was my hunch, is that, like, shape and orbit might be a confounding factor, but...
So, it is something to do with its orbit, but it's not, like, the shape of its orbit or anything. It's more what is still there.
I don't want to spoil it. Let's break this down.
So basically, nowhere in the definition of a planet is mass included, is radius or circumference or anything like that actually stated. So that's really, really interesting.
I mean, I guess it makes sense because who knows? I mean, it would be naive to model it after our solar system
and not consider
other solar systems, right? That's interesting, though.
Let's break this down into this next question, which is, as Tom mentioned, what is the definition of a planet? There are three things.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's a planet.
So there are three things that the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, used to define what a planet is. Can you give me some ideas about what those three things could be.
A consistent orbit.
Orbit comes up a few times, but not necessarily that it has a consistent orbit.
Huh.
But what does it have to orbit?
The sun.
A star?
Yeah, it has to orbit a sun. Possibly what sparked this section of the podcast was me sitting on a TikTok live and asking what the definition of an animal was.
Yeah.
And it's like, everybody knows what that thing is, but nobody knows how to define it. I think planets are exactly the same thing. It's like, we know what a planet is. We live on one. Yet, weeding out what is and isn't a planet is so difficult. The lines are really, really blurry.
Yeah, because you have to think, it's easy to think about it within our context, but then you have to think about it from, like, in the entirety of the universe context, right? Of, like, what are planets?
So typically, the definition is for our solar system, but it would be applicable to every solar system. I lied when I said mass isn't, like, no mass is stated, but why might its mass be important? That's so difficult. Something to do with gravity. There.
I have no idea.
So it has to be a sufficient mass to assume a hydrostatic equilibrium basically meaning it has to be heavy enough to be round.
It has to be round.
Okay. Pretty much. It has to be a nearly round shape.
Okay.
So therefore its mass has to be high enough to draw things in enough to make it a round shape.
I didn't know that's why planets were round.
But that's a very, very simply put way, but yeah.
If you think about how chaotically, like, a stick in space would be wiggling around the sun, right? I think the concept of, like, an equilibrium making it a certain shape makes sense for it to be a planet.
So there is one more thing. And Pluto checks off those first two. It's this third one that Pluto doesn't check off.
Oh, no. Oh, boy.
And it's possibly the hardest one to guess.
I thought you were going to say the hardest one to get. Like, this is the hardest one to achieve as a planet. You've got to study
only
for years.
Only the highest ranking stellar objects can achieve this.
But it is something to do with its orbit. It kind of has something to do with its mass.
Is it not that it has, like, a consistent periodic orbit around a star?
No, that's not
what it is. I already said that, Tom.
Yeah, but I used the word periodic.
Oh, okay, yeah. I made it sound smarter.
Does it have to do with the orbit of its moons?
No.
Wow. Can you give us more clues, but not tell us?
So, Ella, you nearly mentioned it earlier about there being other stuff.
It has to be made of rocks.
It's not to do with the planet itself, but to do with its orbit and what other stuff might be there.
Oh, does it not have to? Oh, I remember now. Wait, hold on.
Oh my God.
Is Pluto a part of the Kuiper Belt?
It is part of the Kuiper Belt. Yeah.
This guy paid attention in astronomy. It has to be, like, I guess, like, oh, this is so cool. Does it have to be, like, solitary and not with, like, a bunch of other objects like the asteroid belt?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. So the actual phrase is it has to have cleared the neighborhood around its orbit.
Oh.
So for anybody who's still a bit confused about what that means.
I definitely had heard this.
Yeah. It's,
wow.
Everybody was talking about it when Pluto was demoted. Essentially what it means is that a celestial body, in this case a planet, is the dominant gravitational force in its orbit. Essentially, there shouldn't be anything in its orbit of a similar size that could compete to be gravitationally dominant apart from its own naturally occurring satellites, aka moons.
Can I say also, by the way, Caroline?
Yeah?
Ella asked you for a better hint and I thought that was impossible, but you nailed it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was really hard on it. It was like, I don't know how to say this without giving it away. So yeah, that's essentially what Pluto failed at, is that there are other things in this. We'll talk about what the Kuiper Belt is
you
as well.
You failed,
in a second,
Pluto.
You fucked up, Pluto. You didn't pass the test. So, as I mentioned previously, before 2006, which is when Pluto's planetary status was changed, there was not a set definition for what a planet was.
Mm-hmm.
And a planet was a term that was used to describe all sorts of things. For a period of time, it was used to possibly describe asteroids. It included moons, which we now refer to as naturally occurring satellites. And minor planets or dwarf planets as well were all encompassed into this one definition of a planet. It wasn't until this definition was proposed in 2006 by the International Astronomical Union.
2006, yeah.
Yeah. And they had this huge general assembly in Prague in 2006.
Pluto's had it too good for too long.
This is what scientists do. They get together and they conspire
to
destroy your favourite planet.
These 2,700 people went to this general assembly, and this assembly wasn't just about what the definition of a planet was or about Pluto. It was this 10-day long general assembly covering a whole bunch of stuff, and the notes from this general assembly are in the show notes if anybody's interested.
Oh, cool.
What I find really, really interesting, though, is that of these 2,700 participants, which were all invited to vote on the new definition and separately if Pluto should be counted or not, only about 10% actually voted.
Oh.
In this.
Oh.
So only around 270 people did. And that's because the discussions about Pluto and what the definition of a planet is were at the end of the assembly.
Oh my god.
So basically, wow. Because of timings, because of it being advertised, all of these sorts of things, not many people relative to the rest of the group actually showed up.
That's so funny.
No way.
That was it, basically. They voted on it. There was a bit of a debate about it. We'll talk about earlier versions of what the definition could have included in a minute.
Ooh.
But I think that's really, really interesting.
I did not know this. Wow.
So, as we mentioned previously, the reason why Pluto doesn't count is because it's situated in this thing called the Kuiper Belt. What essentially that is this disc-shaped area in space. It's in our outer solar system. It extends past Neptune, and it's very, very similar to the asteroid belt that is in between Jupiter and Mars. Basically, it's full of a bunch of stuff. There's just so much stuff out there. Everything from bits of rock and ice, comets, dwarf planets all exist in the Kuiper Belt.
That's a really good quote for space. There's so much stuff out there.
Stuff, you know?
That's the back of the book.
And these things are called Kuiper Belt objects. There are like hundreds and thousands of Kuiper Belt objects, basically. And what I found really interesting is that according to the Space Center Houston website, Kuiper Belt objects are all small objects because they might have come together to form a planet on their own had Neptune not been there.
Whoa.
So Neptune's gravity stirred up this region of space much that these small icy objects weren't able to coalesce into a larger planet.
Oh, fuck Neptune. Everyone against Neptune now.
The reason Pluto's not a planet,
it's Neptune's fault.
But so you're saying that, like, because it's like there and it's so close, when it like moves around the solar system, it just kind of like disturbs things enough that they don't have their own like gravitational like independence to form their own thing.
Essentially,
if that makes sense.
Yeah. So if Neptune hadn't been there, Pluto potentially could have formed into its own bigger planet. Or
that's
possibly
so
one of the or other dwarf planets that are out there. Ooh. But yeah, and that's why we study the Kuiper Belt so much, or one of the reasons why, is that it gives us some idea of like what our early solar system potentially looked like before it had all of these planets.
Oh, that's cool.
Which is so interesting. So, so cool. All of this stuff is going on, and that's why Pluto isn't counted as a planet, because there's just so much other stuff in the Kuiper Belt that it hasn't cleared the neighborhood, and therefore doesn't fit the definition.
Which is such a great point, and something that we take for granted, because I'm like picturing the planets around, and I'm like, what else is there to describe about them? But the fact that there is nothing else in their way is such a great point.
Yeah. And there's a really cool quote later on, which essentially is like, when you look at our solar system, there are these eight large bodies and everything else sort of revolves around them, be it the small bits of debris, be it these other planets, be it Neptune and Neptune's gravity shaking things up in the Kuiper Belt. So that's really, really interesting.
It's like, planets are weird.
Planets be weird, bro.
Like, it would make more sense if it was just like a cloud of chaos, but the fact that there are these planets with clear ways is pretty weird.
It's really, really interesting.
Also, I'm tremendously high right now, I should say.
I can tell.
It's worth saying that this is obviously like a huge oversimplification of how the solar system works, but it's still like a really useful way of visualizing it, you know? So I put that out there. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like talking about space this much. It makes me feel insignificant.
I love the calmness with which you're like, I might have an existential crisis, so let's move along.
That's what I'm doing, sitting here quietly dying.
So, I've said why Pluto doesn't fit into the definition, but I really like this story because there's essentially a reason why all of this was brought into question in the first place.
Mm.
And it was because we discovered something in 2005, which essentially broke the camel's back. And it called into question if Pluto should be a planet at all. So think back, cast your minds back to 2005.
Pluto sent the head of NASA a really nasty email. It was fucked up.
I'm trying to think, was it like an NSYNC single? Was it what? Neopets? Was that what put the
girls back? Doctor Who started again in 2005.
Good point, good point.
Was it another object in the Kuiper Belt?
It was bigger. There's a bigger body than Pluto in the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah, absolutely. So
this poor neglected. I'm finally into it now. Yes.
There you go.
Fuck Pluto. What about this other thing?
This other thing that was at the time labeled as the discovery of a potential 10th planet. Eris. It's spelled E-R-I-S. And it was discovered in 2005, basically.
Oh, Eris.
Wow.
Ah, Eris. It's now classified as a dwarf planet, but at the time, in 2005, it was very much being heralded as a newly discovered 10th planet.
Why did we not see this before?
That's a really good question.
I mean, first of all, it's very far. The thing that's really interesting about the Kuiper Belt is that, like, when you go farther and farther, the circumference of this belt gets like huge.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And so, I mean, I guess, and this is almost like a misconception that we have about, like, there have only very recently been good high definition photos of Pluto as a planet in general.
Yeah, but I think 2015.
Pluto was discovered in 1930, though. So
potentially
it's not...
even earlier than that. I think first initial photographs of it, and they didn't know what it was in like the very early part of the 1900s, which is so interesting.
Hi everyone, Tom here with a quick editor's note. So apparently Eris is 3 times farther from the sun than Pluto. And at the time it was discovered, we thought it was larger than Pluto, but by now we think it's roughly around the same size. But that's probably why we didn't find it first. Also, we mentioned the term dwarf planet, and a dwarf planet is any object that has fulfilled the first two requirements, but not the last one. So it orbits the sun, it has enough mass to be round in shape, but it hasn't cleared its neighboring orbit. So Pluto and Eris are both dwarf planets.
It makes sense that it was at least informally designated as a potential 10th planet. When you compare it to Pluto, it's like, yeah, of course it is. Eris was discovered by Professor Mike Brown of the California Institute of Technology, who has now dubbed himself as the man who killed Pluto, which is really funny. So Eris is not the only dwarf planet in the Kuiper Belt. There's quite a few, to be fair. And some of these planets were being discovered in previous years as well. So in the Kuiper Belt, there's other ones, including Makemake, which was discovered in 2005 as well. Sedna, I believe it's pronounced, which was discovered in 2003. And essentially with all of these planets, in quotation marks, being discovered so physically close together, basically, it kind of forced the International Astronomical Union to establish a definition of what a planet was, because these dwarf planets were so tiny as well.
So like this is what caused the vote to happen.
They were like, this is an exclusive club, you know, we can't just be like any tiny rock in here.
It's like I mean, honestly, because what you must imagine is like the first person who discovers it, they're like, a new planet, and then like as more, it's like another new planet, and it's like another. Maybe these aren't planets.
What I mentioned earlier is that there was an early plan that the IAU were hoping to enforce. And this plan included the number of planets being increased from 9 planets to 12.
Wow.
So an initial plan actually saw Pluto and its moon Charon being recognized as a twin planet because they essentially orbit each other in a sense. So that's one extra planet. Eris was also potentially going to be included as another planet. And there's also another planet, which I'll talk about in a minute, being allowed to join this very, very exclusive club of planets.
So they just thought it's too difficult for children to learn that many names.
I have a quote about that in a second as well. So excited to share some of these with you. We all know about the story of Pluto being demoted, but it's not the first planet to get that treatment.
Excuse me?
There is a planet that was discovered in 1801 by Giuseppe Piazzi, and it's called, I believe it's called Ceres or Ceres, so C-E RES.
Ceres.
And it was discovered in the asteroid belt.
Oh.
Which is really interesting. It was actually one of the first objects to be discovered from the asteroid belt.
Oh, wow.
And that was initially labeled as a planet. It's one of the largest masses in the asteroid belt, and it does fulfill some of the criteria that we mentioned earlier. It orbits the sun, it's got a large enough mass to be that spherical shape. So,
is
everybody
it bigger,
called it a
is
planet.
Is it bigger than Pluto?
No. No, it's not.
All mass isn't everything! We've already said
everything.
This.
So, in the 1850s, we started discovering all of the other stuff in the asteroid belt.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It was a lot of other objects that were of a similar sort of size. So, yeah. In the 1850s, it was actually demoted to being an asteroid rather than being counted as a small planet. Yeah.
Can I say, it's so wild that there is literally the same thing happened.
It's so
like 200 years earlier.
Yeah.
Like the exact same, like, we found one, a new one. Oh, wait, there's a bunch of stuff here.
Mm.
Oh, wait, let's get rid of it. So,
wow.
As we sort of touched on, this planet is teeny fucking tiny, once again, Pluto being around 14 times larger.
Oh, man. So this is like a New York sized.
However, in 2006, it was still up for the position of being one of the 12 planets, basically.
Really?
Yeah. It was essentially like a slightly larger object, which we could potentially, if we have to have Pluto and these other ones,
I know,
in,
it kind of just feels like that probably was like feeling based rather than
yeah.
It's like, I kind of feel like this should be a planet just because I guess so.
Just because like everything else is, I guess. So in 2006, they discussed it at the General Assembly. That plan was scrapped and Pluto was scrapped along with it. However, it has been upgraded from being classed as an asteroid to being classed as a dwarf planet. So it did get that, which is quite nice.
Cool.
It's really, really cool. So it's the only dwarf planet we know of so far in our inner solar system. And it was the first dwarf planet to ever be visited by a spacecraft. It was visited by NASA's Dawn in 2015, which is also really, really sweet. I really love
Very
that.
Cool.
Nice.
I think we can agree that it made a lot of sense not to allocate Ceres as a planet. And a lot of people argue for the similar sort of reason that it makes sense for Pluto as well. As I mentioned earlier, a really nice way of seeing it is that we do have these eight main bodies. And I really liked this quote. If aliens came and visited, those would be the eight things that they would notice first.
Yeah, okay.
We call this the Yelp principle.
Which, like, kind of get that, yeah.
Well, if you visited this country, which would be the eight restaurants that you would want to visit first?
But, so, like, it does make sense that in our solar system there are these eight bodies that sort of dictate what everything else does. To an extent. So it makes sense that they're classed as planets, and anything else that doesn't have a similar sort of impact is classed as a dwarf planet instead. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
However, some scientists still disagree, because of course
really?
They do.
Well, they should have stayed for the fucking vote then.
So a really interesting one, this quote is from Kathy Olkin, who is a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute. And she says, There are just many different ways to decide what a planet is. Pluto has an atmosphere, it has moons, it goes around the sun. Whereas things like Ceres does not have an atmosphere, so that could be a way to distinguish between the two.
I will also add to this point, I feel like I wanted to clarify that, like, when we talk about, like, the asteroid belt and the Kuiper belt as being, like, full of objects, like, they are full of objects, but not, like... It, not in the way that you probably visualize
it's
from movies,
like,
where there's like they're everywhere.
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
Like,
yeah, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
That is
yeah,
exactly. I feel caught in 4K. That's exactly what I'm like picturing.
Yeah, no, it's not that. It's just like relatively busy.
Yeah.
Compared to other parts of our solar system.
So when I drive my spaceship through there, I'm not going to have to be dodging and weaving out of the way.
You'll probably be okay.
If you, but when you.
Yeah, when.
And Kathy Olkin wraps that up by saying, there are still people who are trying to fight the definition.
I mean, hey.
Yeah, fair enough. Some have argued that because there are large pieces of rock and debris in planets' orbits like Earth, that maybe planets like Earth and also Jupiter don't actually meet the IAU definition either.
Could you imagine if we've all voted that Earth wasn't a planet?
Oh my god, please.
Which is so funny.
I would love that. Man. Just do
yeah.
it.
Oh, yeah, that'd be such a meme.
Put Earth in its place. Earth's had it good for too long.
So, Professor Alan Stern, who at the time was chief scientist for the New Horizons mission, called the outcome of this vote an awful decision and described the new definition as internally inconsistent. Which is a bold fucking statement to make.
I feel so, like, I feel bad about saying this, but, like, I just don't feel like this deserves as much, like, passion.
Oh, no. Like, not at all.
It's just, I mean, like, I think space as, like, as a study, like, it absolutely
does.
But I feel like the fight between whether or not Pluto should be classed as a planet is, like, come on, guys.
It's so much, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I can understand how it might affect funding if you're trying to do research about a certain thing.
Yeah, definitely.
But,
and, like, talking about public perception, like, if you're all excited about discovering new planets and then they turn around and go, actually, they're not a planet, like, are the public going to be as interested as they were?
Yeah, okay, fine, I agree with you.
So this is the Professor Mike Brown quote. So this is the man who discovered Eris, who had the chance to be the person who discovered a new planet and had that ripped away from him. He believes it was the right decision as well.
Okay.
So he says,
that's good.
When we first discovered Eris and knew that we had something the size of Pluto or perhaps larger, my first response was, of course, it's a planet, because Pluto's a planet and anything bigger is clearly a planet too. Mm. It never occurred to me that astronomers would have the courage, I think courage is the right word, to demote Pluto. Because astronomers, like everybody else, have this nostalgic feeling about Pluto. Mm. He goes on to say that it's such a beautiful thing. The solar system is arranged in such a beautiful way that these eight dominant things and everything else fitting around between them, that if we can have our cultural view of what the solar system is mesh with the scientific view, I would gladly trade my discovery of the 10th planet for really furthering the overall world's understanding of how the solar system is. I'm very happy with the way it worked out. Which is such a mature way to respond to that.
That's the first thing that's made me really actually be like, yeah, okay, fine. He had the chance to be, like, known, you know, put in a history book or like in a science book as a man who discovered a planet. But because his desire to, like, be accurate and increase knowledge and understanding of a thing he's very passionate about overrode that. That makes me change my opinion on it for sure.
That's really beautiful, yeah.
This is, I'm going to leave you on this quote. I've sort of said everything that we can say about this topic, but there's a really lovely quote from a man named Philip Metzger, who says, back in the early 2000s, there was a lot of excitement when astronomers were discovering new planets in our solar system. He says, all of that excitement ended in 2006. Yet many of those smaller objects are still interesting. Already, there are at least 150 known dwarf planets.
Oh, wow.
Most people, however, are unaware. Indeed, why do we need to limit the number of planets? People can memorize the names and traits of hundreds of dinosaurs or Pokemon. Why not planets? why not inspire people to rediscover and explore space, the space objects that most appeal to them? Maybe, in the end, what makes a planet is in the eye of the beholder.
Aww,
when the moon hits your
cute.
Eye, like a big pizza pie!
It's
that's
so
a
lovely, isn't it? I feel like that quote sort of pulls in everything. We should still be excited about these things, and we shouldn't let the lack of a planetary status dictate that. Go ahead and learn the 150 fucking dwarf planets, because
why
not?
Make a poke rap for the planets.
Yeah, you know?
It'll really help in a pub quiz one day.
One day, yeah. Let it be your next special interest. Do it. Go for it.
Today's miscellaneous topic is animal art.
I'm so excited.
I want to start this by clarifying what I mean when I say that, just to, like, level set with y'all. So there's two things that I think are not animal art.
Mm-hmm.
The first is human art inspired by animals. There's a really beautiful piece by Jeffrey Mann where he 3D tracked the flight of moths around the light and then 3D printed this flowing ribbony flight path.
That's cool.
Great, but I wouldn't say that that's animal art.
Like, an animal did the pattern, but a human still created it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then there's animal things presented as art. So, for example, Bjorn Brown collected a bunch of zebra finch birds' nests that, like, used all sort of human-made materials and plastics.
Yeah.
And I think that's good art to us. I don't think that that's animal art necessarily, because the nest was made functionally.
You mean animals making art for the sake of it being art.
Exactly.
Would you classify, you know, like when owners put their pet's paws into paint and then get them to walk across a canvas?
Yeah.
That falls into that second category of, like...
Yeah, I would say it comes out of a non-artistic behavior,
I guess. It's just a dog walking across a canvas.
Fuck you. Okay. When I've done that with Charlie, it's art.
It's art to us.
We said with dogs, with cats.
With cats, it's beautiful. Like, it's an animal deliberately creating artwork to create artwork, basically.
The animal knows it's art?
Question mark.
Now, see, that's even... And I'm glad you're already getting at these questions, because, like, the reason I wanted to have those clarifications at the first place was because, like, once we start digging into this, we're going to basically be opening, like, two of the messiest questions ever meshed together, right? Which is like, what is art and how capable and intelligent are animals? Which are two questions alone that we definitely can't answer.
Yeah, definitely can't answer.
But it's also why I wanted to approach it from a miscellaneous topic and not a science one, is because I don't think we will get a satisfying scientific answer. But I do think that by looking at these two tough questions against each other, we can get some interesting miscellaneous thoughts about art in general.
I'm really glad as well you brought just like such a simple question to us at the end here, like, what is art?
Yeah, this is like along the same lines as what is an animal and what is a planet? What is art? Falls into a weird, murky ground, doesn't it? Open to a lot of debate.
So I'm going to have a few interesting stories that I've researched to sort of push at this question. But to start, I wanted to ask, do you think animals can make art?
So I have one thought, which is not anything to do with elephants holding paintbrushes or orangutans doing similar things. Like, none of that. The one that I want to pose to you both is I believe it's a type of fish that creates patterns in the sand in order to attract a mate.
Oh.
Would you argue that that potentially is an animal making its own kind of art for a purpose? But yeah, you know, I might try and find a photo of it, because it's really cool.
I think that's interesting. I think mating behaviors are very interesting, because then you, of course, have like bird songs, right? As music, as art. That's very interesting. I feel like mating behaviors is a very gray area. Gosh, I wasn't expecting this gray area.
So it
reminds me as well of like birds, tropical birds who do like really elaborate dance routines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't say that was art. It's still functional, even though it's right. Very beautiful.
Right, and my other question is how varied does it become, right? It could be an intricate pattern that has a very mechanistic rule set to it.
It's a really tough one, because again, it's that question of how do you define art,
right?
Well, okay, this is back to the question you asked, Tom, which is do you think animals can make art?
Yes.
My gut feeling, and this is if you go back to our episode,
right,
where Stephen asks, do insects have consciousness? My gut feeling is no.
Yeah.
Because of my anthropocentric take on the idea that, like, art is, like, intrinsically human. And I don't even what we understand to be art, which is, like, something that elicits emotion in us.
It's a great definition, I think. That's an interesting...
I've never heard of an example where an animal has, like, looked at something, Mm-hmm. And then that's like elicited emotion that's been made by them. That's elicited emotion in them.
I think that's a really wonderful definition to when we think about this. And so, Caroline, I don't know. Do you stand on a yes or a no if you had to? I know this is a
murky
question.
One other sort of question, which is like the idea of magpies liking shiny things and therefore decorating their homes with it.
This is like the that I would change my opinion, which is like smart birds like corvids that collect things.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna, this is great. I'm gonna, let's dive in before I leave you guys to your devices, you will write this topic yourselves also, but let's go in so I can talk about some of these stories. So I want to start with a story I learned in college that kind of inspired this. So there have been a number of animal quote unquote painters.
Yeah.
One of my favorites is Picasso, the pig who paints. There's also a capuchin monkey named Pocket's Warhol.
Oh my God.
Because apparently his white fur around his face reminded the owner of Andy Warhol. But there's one story that gets told a lot. There are some sources on it, but not a lot. So grain of salt, but it is a good story. So.
Yeah.
The story goes that in 1964, the Swedish artist O.K. Axelson saw the abstract paintings of Pierre Brassou and was curious, in the way that some people say, like, my child could do this or a monkey could do this, if he could get an ape to paint a piece and convince a gallery that it was a real work of art.
Uh-huh.
So I'll send you an example of Brassou's work that like inspired this.
Okay, yeah, I see where the argument's coming from there. It's very abstract, isn't it?
To describe this image, it is what looks to be just directionless brush strokes in red and orange.
Yeah.
In acrylic paint and with no discernible figures.
It really, there's like one red spiky blob in the bottom half and then some like orangey streaks in the upper section, but less, no,
I don't feel like it deserves that much of an explanation, Caroline, to be honest.
You know, fair. Very fair.
Do you guys see the artistic value in this particular painting?
No. I'm not going to, like, slam anyone who does, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not the kind of person who walks into, like, a modern art gallery and is like, that's shit, I can do that.
Stupid.
Don't like that. You're stupid if you like it. But I'm also allowed to be like, I don't think this is good art. Like, you know.
I wouldn't want this in my home, and I don't necessarily understand paying a large amount of money for something like that.
Mm-hmm.
However, I'm not going to turn around and say that it doesn't elicit any sort of emotions in anybody, because like I just don't have that experience.
Yeah, I'm sure it's meaningful to someone.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it's meaningful to the artist that created it. Yeah,
I feel like there are certain Pollock paintings that have a similar sort of
I also don't particularly rate Pollock either, though, so
yeah. So I lied. This was painted by Pierre Brassou, but Pierre was the ape.
Okay.
Oh, never mind, take it back.
Yeah, this is amazing. It's one of the best pieces of work I've ever seen.
The part that I take back specifically is me being like, maybe I can see where like the artist has an emotional response to the work that they're creating. No, I don't.
So Peter, as he's actually named, was a West African chimpanzee who lived in a Swedish zoo. And Axelson convinced the zoo to give Peter some paint. According to Time magazine, quote, he painted all over the floor. He painted all over his keeper. He even painted all over a few canvases. He ate whole tubes of cobalt blue, leading to the speculation that its tart flavor was what inspired him to use it in his work sometimes.
I think that this is a fantastic enrichment activity for an animal.
I'm glad he had a good time.
Caroline, I'm glad you mentioned that. We are going to get into that in a second. Ooh. But so the work was presented in a gallery, and I found one source for these quotes. I think because they were originally in Swedish, but at the same time, grain of salt. But allegedly one critic said, Pierre Brassou paints with powerful strokes, but also with clear determination. His brush strokes twist with furious fastidiousness.
Oh, fuck me.
Pierre is an artist who performs with the delicacy of a ballet dancer.
I really don't want to be like this person, but because like I'm not trying to be edgy by saying it, but like art critics are some of the biggest fucking bullshitters.
Yeah.
in like, what is that job? I actually do think this is art, by the way, because of the intention behind it. The guy who gave Peter the paint, his intention was to show that anyone could do something like this.
That
for gives it purpose and actually does elicit quite emotional response.
We'll get into that in a second. I completely agree.
Was it the animal that was the artist or the human who was the artist?
See, I really could just give you guys the question and then just have you write this topic, apparently.
I'm so sorry, Tom.
Oh, and then the question is, would I be writing the topic if I...
And Caroline and I are just the animals painting on the canvas.
So I didn't say that. You said that. So, to your point, Ella, I think this stems from the fact that art is so subjective that the idea that a critic can say it for all people is kind of ludicrous. But you might agree more with this critic who allegedly said that...
Looks like a monkey painted it.
Only an ape... that allegedly said only an ape could do this.
Oh, okay. Well, whoever that is, fine. Maybe there are good art critics out there.
So, to put to my words what I think some of you were getting at, it's true on the one hand that a lot of art is as chaotic and as simple as this, right? Like, I said that Pierre was described as painting wildly on the floor, but that's literally how Jackson Pollock painted his splatter paintings too, right? As he put it, quote, "My painting does not come from the easel. I prefer to tack the unstretched canvas to the hard wall or the floor. I need the resistance of a hard surface." And in fact, the paint-strewn floor of Jackson Pollock's studio is something that you can visit and look at like a piece of art.
That's really cool.
Similarly, Rothko's color field paintings are just those like large swaths of colors. If you've ever seen those before, it'll just be like a big red and then like a big blue, like just rectangle. And then most infamously, there's Duchamp's ready-mades. There's the one that's titled Fountain that is literally just a urinal presented at a gallery.
Yeah.
But to Ella's point, I think what's important in all of those works of art is context, right? They lack structure, but that's on purpose. That's like the point, right? The same year that Duchamp started his series that he called These Ready-Mades, he wrote down in his notebook, "Can one make works which are not works of art?" So that was his purposeful question in doing this. And I think one thing that gets ignored in Pierre's story that both of you pointed out is the steps done by a human to get it into the context of a gallery, right? The naming of the painting, the framing, bringing it to a gallery. Mm-hmm. And he also signs it at the bottom, which I think is very funny. I don't think Pierre did that.
That would be really impressive.
Uh-huh.
And what I find really interesting that this brings up, and something that I love about contemporary art, is that the act of presentation itself is a transformative art.
Yeah,
right?
Definitely, yeah.
And we see this all the time in art in really beautiful ways. One of my favorite works is, there's a really evocative piece that's by Robert Rauschenberg, and it's called Erased de Kooning Drawing. You can probably guess what it is by the title, basically Rauschenberg asked the famous artist Willem de Kooning to draw something for him, and then he erased it, framed it, and gave it that title, and that's what it looks like.
To describe, it looks like some erased pencil markings on a canvas. I can't even describe. There was probably some figures in it at some point. You can't really see.
But it is interesting that you start to be like, can I see anything in this?
Yeah.
Is there anything left? As the SF MoMA put it, quote, "The power of erased de Kooning drawing derives from the allure of the unseen and from the enigmatic nature of Rauschenberg's decision to erase a de Kooning. Was it an act of homage, provocation, humor, patricide, destruction, or, as Rauschenberg once suggested, celebration? Erased de Kooning drawing eludes easy answers, its mysterious beginnings leaving it open to a range of present and future interpretations."
That's very nice description for something that I don't get any feelings out of at all. I'm sorry, it just does. I can't. I understand why you like it. I just.
The thing that makes me feel about it is the thought that, like, there is possibly a chance that people look at this piece of work of. Who's the original artist? De Kooning.
De Kooning.
His other works might not get the same attention anymore. Because this piece exists and people contemplate this piece.
I think he's quite famous, right? Like his other works are. That's why it was
why this one would matter. But I do think that like people would sit and tried to interpret this.
I mean, to be fair, I heard about this before I had heard of other de Kooning works. Yeah.
What this reminds me of, this piece in particular, reminds me of, the graffiti artist Banksy. Yeah. And his recent piece, which was auctioned off, and as soon as it sold, it was, like, shredded.
Yeah. It was shredded,
and it added so much more value to that piece, mm-hmm. being shredded than whole, that it just kind of, like, summarized to me the kind of, I don't know, there's, like, just a kind of ridiculousness in art sometimes, where, like, the thought experiment of it, or the insane praise for an artist, like, that feels unwarranted sometimes. And that I kind of, like, it really grates me sometimes.
I'll show you another example of where context makes the art that I think is just more fun, mm-hmm. But has a similar principle. So this is something I saw at the Met recently. I actually took this picture.
It's a kind of beige canvas with some Perspex boxes stuck to it.
Like little display boxes almost, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. There was an exhibit at the Met that was put on by museum employees.
Oh.
And this is a work by Sean Thomas. And at first I was like, what? Is there something in there really small that I can't see? Like, what are... It's a bunch of glass cases. And then I read the title, and the title was Case Study.
Yeah, that's good.
And in the context of it all, it makes it hilarious and also, like, interesting.
That's very fun.
But again, it is literally, it is the context of doing this in this situation that makes it the art, I think.
I want to say, like, I know I sound, like, deeply cynical and, like, someone who goes around, like, art exhibits, like, saying, you know, horrible things. The Tate
First
Modern.
First shit on Pluto and now this.
Like, sorry.
Oh my God, Ella.
the Tate Modern, which is the kind of, like, biggest modern art gallery in the UK, it's not that far from where I live. It's my favorite place in London, if not the country. I absolutely hate loads of stuff going on there. And I also absolutely, like, adore a lot of what I see. There's, you know, it's not like I spend all my time being heavily critical. I think I just really understand what I do and don't like from modern art.
Yeah, definitely.
That's fair. I think that's totally valid. I think that's why people are confused at museums, because they assume that everything they have to like. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really liberating to be like, some I don't like, some I do. Yeah.
And I love meaning, and I love meaning and context behind things. Yeah. And I think it adds a lot more to it. I think one of the things I don't like is when that meaning and context is, like, really centered around the... not the artist's lived experience, but the artist being the artist.
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, in this gallery context, it's sort of a gray area whether this is art. But there's another context that Caroline actually mentioned, which is to think about it, surprisingly, from a scientific perspective.
No science in the miscellaneous topic!
So I think... Caroline mentioned this word, and I feel like Ella might know it too. I learned about this from a friend of mine, but animals that are held in zoos or captivity for science, if they are cognitively intelligent enough, are legally required in the US to have something called enrichment.
Yeah, boy.
And as the Smithsonian describes, quote, enrichment gives animals a creative outlet for physical activity and mental exercise, as well as choice and control over how they spend their time. Examples of enrichment include puzzle feeders that encourage animals to forage for food, climbing structures that enhance habitats, and training sessions where animals can interact with keepers. And some zoos use art making as a form of enrichment.
Yeah.
So, for example, like Caroline mentioned, giving an elephant a paintbrush and, with the help of a zoo attendant, painting a painting. But now that we have the operative definition of enrichment value, we can actually measure, does making art meaningfully affect the behavior of elephants?
Ooh. Oh, does it make them happier?
Exactly.
Does it make the elephant feel something? Which is essentially what art is if it makes you feel something.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
That's the definition that Ella had. So there is an amazing study done by Megan English and her team in 2014 titled, Is Painting by Elephants in Zoos as Enriching as We Are Led to Believe?
If the answer's no, I'm going to be so mad just putting that out there.
Oh no, Tom's face is saying it's no.
As the paper explains, it's not a hard no.
Okay.
It's not like it makes them miserable. So it's so as the paper explains, painting by elephants in zoos is commonly believed to be a form of enrichment, but this assumption has not been based on any systematic research. If an activity is enriching, we would expect stress-related behavior to be reduced. but we found no evidence of the elephants anticipating the painting activity and no effect on the performance of stereotyped or other stress-related behavior either before or after the painting session. Hence, the benefits of this activity appear to be limited to the aesthetic appeal of these paintings to the people viewing them.
Wow. Yeah. I probably would have guessed that, to be fair.
Yeah.
But this actually proves that animals are artists because, as we all know, all true art is suffering.
Yay! Yay!
No. So, yeah, to assuage Caroline, the paper says there's no effect positive or negative.
Okay.
And that it seems like, it seems that if they are getting anything out of it, it's just spending time with the trainers, which I think is sweet.
That's so sweet.
But I really like this study because it gives a more scientific answer to what sounded like an impossible question, yeah. Right? But they measured things like vocalizations, ear positioning, to see if painting made the elephants feel different. Uh-huh. I think it's so clever. And I think it's really interesting that inadvertently, Ella and Caroline, you sort of derived this by your definitions of what art is and thinking about animal behavior. But I think it's a really clever way to look at this question. And I think there's a ton of room for scientific study to, because we haven't done this with apes. We haven't done this with monkeys. And so
I would love to be able to do this with corvids in some way. That'd be so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. All this to say that there's a lot of room for scientific study to slowly show us more answers to this tough question. But that takes time and that's boring.
You heard it here. Science is boring.
I thought you said no science in the mist. Anyway, if we want a hard and fast answer, we need to go somewhere. The miscellaneous topic doesn't usually go, but I feel like we should go more often because it's so entertaining. And to get there, I'm going to slightly rephrase the question. Can an animal create legal art?
Wait, what?
Can an animal create art, legally speaking?
Can an animal, like, own the copyright to a piece of artwork?
Oh.
Are we going to be talking about copyright law?
Oh, yeah, baby. This is where we're going. So, y'all may have heard of this story. Are you familiar with Naruto?
Yeah.
So Naruto is a manga series and eventually a highly popular anime that was actually created by a team of crested macaques. Naruto is the name of a Celebes crested macaque, which is a monkey that famously took a selfie of itself smiling in 2011.
Oh, I feel like we've all seen that photo.
So David J. Slater was in Indonesia photographing this endangered crested macaque species, and he would get in really close with them. At one point, he said he let the macaques groom his hair.
Aww.
And so because they were so playful, he has this idea to just like put the camera down and let them play with it. And so what I didn't realize is that because of the reflective lens, they would point the camera at themselves because they could see their reflection.
Oh, that's so cute.
They would end up taking photos of themselves, and one of these photos was a macaque grinning, taking a selfie. I'll have a link these photos in the show notes, but I imagine y'all have seen this because, well, what ended up happening is that the Daily Mail gets this press release. They embellish the story a bit, obviously. They make it sound like the monkeys stole the camera. and the photo went all over the internet. But where this gets dicey is when this image gets uploaded to Wikipedia. Because the only images that are allowed on Wikipedia are ones that are either public domain, licensed by the Wikimedia Foundation, or fair use. And the Wikipedia editor who added it noted that, quote, "This file is in the public domain because, as the work of a non-human animal, it has no human author in whom copyright is vested."
Okay.
Right.
I would have assumed that the owner of the camera would hold the copyright.
Yeah.
Right. This is what Slater argues. So, to get into what actually happened, first off, one thing I didn't realize when I first heard the story is that the legal case was not between Wikipedia and Slater.
Oh.
Slater actually didn't sue anybody. He planned to, and he talked about it. But the group that filed the lawsuit that made these headlines was actually PETA against Slater in defense of Naruto. Because...
Why are Peter like this? Why are they like this?
Because Slater was selling books that had this artwork in it, and they claimed that that was infringement on Naruto's copyright.
Oh, my God.
So, what's Naruto going to do with the copyright?
What's he going to do with them? Give him the money. Just like
give him the money. What's he going to do
and give
it?
Him a, say we've opened a bank account for you, and do you do what you want with that? This is just, it's just a stunt. Peter do this to like get attention, so it's not like a real thing that they don't actually
no
care.
No wonder Peter get the shit taken out of them, you know?
So the three people involved in this are Slater, who says he is the author of it.
Yeah.
Peter, who says that Naruto is the author of it. And Wikipedia, who says that no one is the author of it. So understandably, George Orrick, who presided over it, would eventually throw the case out.
Yeah, of course.
But he did say, quote, "This is an issue for Congress and the president. If they think animals should have the right of copyright, they're free, I think, under the Constitution to do that." You know, which doesn't say one way or the other. But
If an animal ever asked for copyright, I'm sure we'd be more than willing to give it to them.
But what's interesting is the U.S. Copyright Office did chime in on the matter. And in a story of animals making art, this is by far the most wild quote I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Y'all, legal stuff is bananas. So this is a quote from an updated version of the 1300-page compendium of U.S. Copyright Office practices, which in section 313, subsection 2, I've always wanted to say something like that. I feel so smart. The updated subsection states, quote, "As discussed in section 306, the Copyright Act protects original works of authorship. To qualify as a work of authorship, a work must be created by a human being. Works that do not satisfy this requirement are not copyrightable. The U.S. Copyright Office will not register works produced by nature, animals, or plants. Likewise, the office cannot register a work purportedly created by divine or supernatural beings."
So when like people claim that Jesus made a picture of himself in their toast, that's not copyrightable.
Yeah, you'd have to admit that you did it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Caroline, they provide examples. So examples of things that don't count include a photograph taken by a monkey, which I think they added after this, a mural painted by an elephant, a claim based on the appearance of actual animal skin, a claim based on driftwood that has been shaped and smoothed by the ocean. I think that's a really interesting example.
Okay.
So the ocean can't make a claim is what they're saying.
Yeah. Or no, a human can't claim it.
So artists who collect driftwood and put it on like a platform of some sort and then sell it can't claim copyright of that piece of work.
Right, they can't claim copyright of the design of that driftwood.
I'm surprised about the elephant, like something where if you own that animal and that animal produces artwork, but like it feels weird to me that you couldn't claim that as your own copyright.
Yeah, and so this is again the distinction between copyright and like, you know, selling of it's again, I don't want to get too
don't
deep into it because I'm not a lawyer
too much. Yeah,
they also say any claims based on cut marks, defects, and other qualities found in natural stone, and any application for a song naming the Holy Spirit as the author of the work.
A song?
That's so funny.
So, to Caroline's point, Slater could still file a lawsuit, and some expert think he could win the case, but right now, legally, in the U.S., this photograph is not a work of art that belongs to Slater, but at the same time, Naruto doesn't qualify as legal authorship either.
So Wikipedia was right?
I think so.
Oh.
And that's a stance they still take on any artwork that's produced by... Because there's a handful of other ones that they claim that it's not made by a human, so it's in the public domain.
Right.
So, to take a look at everything so far, from a gallery and museum perspective, it's a gray zone. From a scientific enrichment perspective, it's a gray zone. And even from a legal perspective, it's a gray zone. But fortunately, to Ella's point, I don't think any of these perspectives matters to what actually art is. I don't know if it's come across as I try to, because I'm trying to feel both sides of this to make this entertaining. But when it comes to the like, what is art alignment chart, I am like a hard radical everything is art person, especially art. Not as like a commercially viable thing, but art as a thing that you like doing. Like art as play almost.
Yeah.
I've been reading Linda Barry's book, Making Comics, and Linda Barry is amazing. And she talks a lot in the foreword of the book about the magical nature of children's drawings as a form of art. So as she puts it, quote, "We draw before we are taught. We also sing, dance, build things, act, and make up stories long before we are given any deliberate instruction. Everything we have come to call the arts seems to be in almost every three-year-old. We were doing all of these things before we knew what it was we were doing." And there's also a great story from artist and art teacher Howard Ikimoto that has made its round on the internet many times, but I don't care. I love it. I don't care if you've literally read this on Pinterest today. You're going to hear it again. So it goes, quote, "When my daughter was about 7 years old, she asked me one day what I did at work. I told her I worked at the college, that my job was to teach people how to draw. She stared back at me, incredulous, and said, 'You mean they forget?'"
No.
And one thing we know for certain is that a lot of animals do play. That's a whole topic for another time. Yeah. It's super interesting. But play is observed in a lot of animal species. And so my line in the sand for this question is, my opinion personally, is that if animals can play, they can make things or do things that might not seem like art that we know, but might be art to them.
Yeah.
Right? So while elephant painting might not be art to elephants because it doesn't make them feel something, maybe playing in water is their art, right? And to Caroline's point, I literally wrote this. If a bird gathers shiny objects in a way that makes it happy, that's art. I would count that. If a dog arranges its stuffed animals in a cozy way, I think that's kind cute. Of art. I think when a dolphin makes a bubble ring to entertain its friends, that's art.
Oh, I like that.
I think it's very possible for animals to make art all the time that we just can't appreciate. And that's fine, right? Because like, if everyone understood true art objectively, then, you know, we'd have a lot more 5-star reviews on iTunes.
Quite frankly, we make art that each other don't understand. Of course animals make art that we don't understand, and that's
I think asking these questions and considering these things, I think, open really interesting questions, not just for animal art, but also human art at the same time.
Yeah.
I also want to say that I'm with you on that. I also believe that everything is art. Like, I feel like it might not have come across that way, but I do. I just don't like a lot of it. It's still art.
I think that's a great distinction. I think that's totally fair,
And I generally love talking about art and, like, asking these sorts of questions. Because, again, same with, like, conspiracy theories make my brain work in a different way. This, like, brings something out in all three of us where we're all,
strong opinions.
Our brains are working in very different ways to how it usually does. And we're contemplating things that maybe we wouldn't usually think about. And therefore presenting both of those questions is really, it's nice. It's fun, you know? And I think that's the whole point of the miscellaneous topic.
The point is, now whenever you watch Planet Earth, you can constantly be going like, is that art? Is this art?
Yeah, pretty much. Do we have...
No.
Oil?
Shh. You know what time it is, kids. It's...
I got so put in my place right there. It's... Oh my god.
You know how this starts, Caroline. It's Review Corner. Review Corner has no theme song. We'll change it every time.
So we're gonna make it this time. Woo, yeah.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Review Corner. Today I wanted to do two short ones, because I appreciate even the little ones. So this first one comes from Ali Flowers, and they go, "So fun, so interesting, so pure. This podcast is my new favorite. I love the energy, love the topics, love the banter. Keep it up, you guys."
Yay, thanks, Ali.
This other little review comes from podcasts.r.life.
love them so much, whoever you are. Say, I love you.
"Simply flawless. Never before have I binged every episode of a podcast as fast as I did the first time I met the true gem that is LLE."
Our podcasts are bloody long as well, so that's really appreciated.
Thanks, everyone. And you too can leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
You too as in me and Caroline?
It helps us a lot.
Let's do it, Ella.
No, you too as in the band You Too.
It does mean a lot to us and help the podcast, so thank you. Any shout-outs or things to promote?
Yeah, I'm going to promote us. We have a Discord server.
Yes.
And you can come and hang out with us. The link is on letsleareverythingpod.com. Yeah, so come and hang out with us over there.
I am Tom Lumperson on all places on the social medias.
I'm Caroline the Bug in all places on the social medias.
I'm Dr. Big Science Energy on TikTok. And I want to pose a question to people who have made it this far through the podcast. Oh. Should I put underscores back into my... username, because I think it's really hard to distinguish between the end words, the science and energy.
Can I propose an idea which I did for my old username, which was caroline.rope.arts.
The dots are interesting. podcast.r.live.
Yeah.
Anyway, if you have an opinion, go on our Discord and tell me. Ella Hubba on Twitter. And today we learnt that the more conspirators are part of a conspiracy theory, the more likely it is to catastrophically fail. We learnt why it's important that Pluto is not a planet, and I was very moved by some quotes at the end there.
Thank you.
And we learnt what the meaning of art is.
We answered what art is. Yeah, definitively.
Please join us next time, where we will learn about everything.
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced by Caroline Roper, Tom Lum, and Ella Hubba. Editing by Tom Lum and Ella Hubba. And music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
Let's learn everything. Let's learn everything.
Jesus Christ.
Thing.
Oh my God.
Wow.
What excuse do I have? What excuse do I have to make a metal intro? What holiday can I make a metal version of the theme song for?